This is The Guardian.
Just a warning before we start. This episode contains references to family, domestic, and sexual violence. Please take care while listening. I'm Noor Haidar, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is the full story.
1, 2, 3, 4. We won't take it anymore!
27 women have died violently in Australia this year. In almost all cases, a man has been charged. Across the nation, thousands of people have been demanding action.
We need to change the culture. We need to change attitudes. We need to change the legal system. We need to change the approach by all governments. Because it's not enough to support victims. We need to focus on the perpetrators and focus on prevention.
But have we heard it all before?
We have to act as a male society to bring down this appalling incidence of violence towards women which we see in Australia.
If you hit a woman, you're not a man. That's my message to my fellow males.
Disrespecting women does not always result in violence against women. But all violence against women begins with disrespecting women.
For many years, political leaders have condemned violence against women and expressed platitudes about the need for change. But government policies to reduce gender-based violence have failed. And frontline services say they're severely underfunded. Today, what will it take to stop men killing women? It's Tuesday, the 30th of April.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Jess, there have been mass protests like this before. Does this moment feel any different?
It feels different in the sense that probably not since 2021 have we had such a febrile and fevered atmosphere about gendered violence. So is this time a turning point?
Jess Hill is a journalist and educator on coercive control.
I think it really depends on how much pressure is sustained on federal and state governments. At the moment, I'm really disappointed with the federal government's messaging about this. And when Katie Gallagher said this morning, for example, on ABC News Breakfast, if governments could have fixed this, it would already be fixed.
So it really is about how we can all work together and show the leadership, but also accept that we need everyone to play a part, because if government could solve this problem, it would have been solved.
Nonsense. Nonsense. Governments have made the women's sector plead for funding since its inception. Governments make a choice to make the women's sector plead for funding, they make the choice to make them feel poor, and then they suggest that if they were to give them more funding, other services would have to suffer. So they make women feel greedy for asking. And there's no question that there is a just a very simple dollar component to this whole argument, which is if you've got refuges turning away one in two women, that's a statistic from a few years ago. If you've got community legal centres that cannot meet demand, and then you're out there as leaders saying, women particularly, if you leave, we will support you, then you are lying to women. Mm-hmm. and you are giving them a false sense of hope and security that if they leave their coercive controlling partners or if they seek some sort of restitution for sexual violence or help, that they will get the help they need. But then they're not funding the services that provide that help adequately.
Mm. Jess, you know this, but some of our listeners might not. In 2015, my mum was murdered by my dad. In preparation for this interview, I went through some of the data published by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and I went back to that year. In that year, there were 103 women listed as victims of family and domestic violence-related homicides. In the following year, there were 94, then 72, and so on. Of course, that doesn't capture the full picture, but we know that rates of domestic violence have not decreased, and in the case of sexual violence, they have increased over that period. Why haven't we seen improvements?
Well, I mean, first of all, Nora, your story was so much on my mind when I was coming here today, and you were on my mind and your sisters were on my mind. And because I think that for yourselves and for so many other families who are still grieving the loved ones who have been murdered, who have gone missing, who have suicided in the context of coercive control, this last couple of weeks may feel...
It's hard.
Hard.
It's exhausting.
And it may feel somewhat vindicating to see a community sort of rise up and say that they want more action, but it also brings back all of that feeling of, well, why wasn't something done to stop my loved one dying? And all of this gets politicised very quickly. There is just the basic thing of these families grieving, and I just really want to take space with that for you and for others who are listening. So why hasn't this changed since 2015 when it became an absolute focus nationally? And the backbone of our national prevention strategy, and this also goes to the states as well, is that in order to prevent gendered violence, we need to stop it before it starts. So we need to address the gendered drivers of violence. We need to change social norms and attitudes. That's how we define primary prevention. Now, I think 10 years ago, that was quite a... you could almost say quite a radical approach. It was innovative, and we thought it held great promise. I would say that in the 10 years since, with, you know, many tens of millions of dollars invested in this approach, we're seeing very slow incremental progress in terms of community attitudes. In the realm of attitudes towards domestic violence between 2017 and 2021, improvements to those attitudes stalled entirely. So I think that we can look to now that this, having this as the central prevention strategy that we're looking at this long-term cultural change, is not getting the results that the community needs, and it's not getting the results that victim survivors and frontline services expect.
So Jess, the data tells us that there have not been positive changes, but have we made any improvements during that time?
I would say that a number of things have changed. First of all, a real focus on coercive control and the nature of that, and actually explaining what domestic and family violence looks like, what it actually is. Now, in New South Wales and Queensland, we've obviously introduced laws around coercive control, and they also, after a lot of campaigning, they also restored the single parenting payment to single parents with children older than 8. We know that 60% of single mothers are survivors of domestic violence. 50% of those were living in poverty with their children, and worse still, were on JobSeeker a large amount of the time, were having to meet mutual obligations through horrible punitive programs like Parents Next. Now, the federal government, they restored the SEP single parenting payment to kids up to age 14, and they abolished Parents Next, which was particularly punitive for Aboriginal people, and there'd been calls for a long time to get rid of that.
Jess, in 2022, the government released a national plan. It was agreed to by all states and territories. It describes violence against women as a problem of epidemic proportions, and it sets out a target of ending violence against women and children within one generation. Do you think that that is achievable?
Well, I think that it's not. But I think that the government has made a firm commitment to do that, and I think they should be held accountable to that. If they want to make those big promises, then they need to really radically innovate the way that they fund, approach, and conceptualize this problem. And there's a lot of aspects that have not even properly been drawn into the national plan. And there's still very little intersection between the domestic and family violence response and the response to child abuse and maltreatment. And the fact that those two areas are still so siloed is like astonishing. The idea that there's not this very clear link and a work path from government from childhood trauma to domestic and family violence perpetration, but also victimisation, that's just an accepted fact. It's evidence that you have, when you have those situations in childhood, there is at least more prone to having those situations repeat in adulthood. And why aren't we connecting those two areas as a matter of urgency?
Next, have we got prevention wrong?
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Jess, you've written an essay and a piece for The Guardian where you argue that governments have an obligation to pivot our violence prevention strategy. Can you explain what you mean by that?
So what myself and Professor Mike Salter have put forward in this paper is that we need to rethink the way that we approach and conceptualize prevention, and that we owe that to victims and their families. And essentially what we're saying is that state and federal governments need to prioritise more innovative and results-based prevention strategies that will reduce violence over the short, medium and long term. So we identify what we say are four kind of missing pieces to when we talk about prevention. The first is accountability and consequences for perpetrators and the systems that enable them. Now, that is prevention, because prevention really is not just about how do we stop this 12-year-old boy from becoming a perpetrator 10 years later. Prevention is also how do we stop violent and controlling people from using violence against their partner right now, against the next partner, and the next partner, and the next partner. Serial perpetrators are a major problem, but I think that we also look to other ways that accountability and consequences can be brought in within communities, having much greater coordination between all of the various services, from the refuge to the alcohol and drug service to the youth service to the police, to child protection, coordinating them much closer so that they are sharing information, they are working on cases together, but they are also intervening early. The second area is that recovery is so obviously prevention, and the National Recovery Alliance was probably the first to really articulate that. And that's to say that if you grow up with coercive control, or if you grow up being physically or sexually abused or being shamed or neglected by your parents, you are dealing with emotional issues and real trauma that needs support. And to just leave kids sort of as attachments or accessories to the victim parent who's getting support, to not attend to what they need, we're missing an opportunity both to give kids what they are owed, I think, by society, which is the proper attention to help them thrive and survive. But secondly, for those kids who are going to end up being more prone to being victimized or to perpetrating, not in the some long-term future, but possibly in their adolescence, we need to be intervening really early. And not just carving it off as early intervention. This is prevention. This is preventing the next cycle, the intergenerational cycle of violence.
So, Jess, those are two of the areas that you've suggested there needs to be a greater focus. But you've also listed another two, including regulating damaging industries. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yeah. So while, yes, there is a role for all of us to play, many of us play it day to day. The roles and responsibilities of every citizen is not equal to those in positions of power. That goes for both political leaders, but also for corporate leaders. And I think that at the moment, we talk so much about safe and respectful workplaces, and we talk about workplaces, you know, improving in terms of gender equality, and we talk about working with them to achieve that. What we don't talk so much about are the industries who profit from products that exacerbate violence, that to some extent cause greater stresses inside these families that can lead to violence. Mm. Now, at the moment, when we talk about so often, and I say we, I'm talking about often government ministers, they talk about porn and gambling and alcohol and social media, and they talk about having better conversations around those to give context to what 11-year-olds are seeing, you know, on iPads being shown by older kids and having, you know, violent practices like non-fatal strangulation and completely mainstreamed before they've even had a chance to have a romantic relationship. Like, why are they saying these do-nothing, say-nothing platitudes of, well, we all just need to be having better conversations? That's They know that that is bollocks, and they wouldn't take a similar approach to any other public health issue. They wouldn't say the same about smoking. This government, more than 10 years ago, took incredible risks to regulate smoking and make it an unattractive and an inaccessible choice. Mm. They are not lacking courage all the time, but I think they have been caught on the back foot, and I don't think they're responding well to this.
Mm. Just to clarify, Jess, the government consulted with experts, they held roundtables, they spoke to victim survivors to create this national plan that was announced back in 2022. Are you saying that it should be abandoned?
I don't think we just throw all of that work out the window. I would like to see another iteration sooner rather than later. I think that we could certainly do something more with the action plan part of this. So you've got the national plan, which talks about strategy, what sort of outcomes we're looking at, what sort of areas we're focusing on. And then you have an action plan that says, here's how the states and territories are going to seek to meet those. Mm. And to be honest, and this is what I've heard from most people who look at that action plan, is that it's a bit of a dog's breakfast. Now, that's not the federal government's fault. They just went to the states and territories and said, what have you got planned to meet this? It's very inconsistent. There are some states that favour certain types of strategies, other states that favour other types of actions. I would say that it would be great to get more of a consistent approach to what actions can be taken state by state, understanding that each state and territory is going to have some differences. The Northern Territory is going to have a different response to that of New South Wales. But I think that there was a bit of a back of the napkin feeling to that action plan. And if we were going to really change something, I would be much more interested in focusing on the action plan than rewriting the strategy.
So, Jess, in the past, Indigenous academics and advocates have urged caution against knee-jerk responses, particularly given that Indigenous women are often misidentified as the primary aggressors. How important is it in a moment like this, when there are calls for change, that we pause to ensure that we strike the right balance?
Essential. And Antoinette Braybrook from JIRA was on the ABC this morning saying exactly that, which is that you need to have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women particularly, but also men who work with violent men at the table during these discussions.
We've got to stop labelling this issue as violence in Aboriginal communities. It creates an invisibility and compromises Aboriginal women's safety further. This is a gendered issue for Aboriginal women, and we need to start naming it that.
It's also really important, Antoinette made this point, and I don't think it can be made enough, that when you're talking about violence against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, you're also talking about a large amount of that violence being perpetrated by non-Indigenous men.
Our women are partnered with men from many different cultures and backgrounds, so it's not an Aboriginal problem as such.
So it's a complicated problem in that way. You know, as I've seen, Aboriginal women too often are punished for seeking help.
Aboriginal women seeking safety, but they're treated as criminals. They're misidentified, criminalised and incarcerated.
They're punished because they don't look like the right type of victim. They're punished because they've used violent resistance or self-defence because they didn't trust systems to protect them, or they felt like if they reached out for help, child protection would be onto them taking their kids. So if we're looking at offender registries, well, who's going to be on that registry? And what's the checks and balances to make sure that they are offenders and not just being misidentified? The women's prisons are, you know, teeming with women who have been subjected to violence and been arrested for defending themselves. So you've just got to have these people who work with this every day and see the unintended consequences of it at the table mitigating the risks.
Some have begun calling for a royal commission. What is your view on that? Do we need another deep dive inquiry, or will it tell us more of what we already know?
So it's, you know, it's not for me really to say whether or not we should have a royal commission. It's really for the sector to say. Now, a royal commission will be very expert heavy with some frontline, a little bit of lived experience, probably focusing more on the lived experience that already has a platform, which there's nothing wrong with that, absolutely not. But there's it's not a really democratic process. So that's all I would say is that if we want to go down the path of hosting something, investing in a fact-finding mission, just think about what does that mission want to achieve and how can we best achieve it?
Mm. Jess, we've talked about the lack of funding for frontline services. The other thing that people say is missing is the political will. Does it worry you that without change, dramatic change, you and I will be having this conversation in another decade?
I think we definitely will be, sorry. you know, there is a major paradigm shift that governments need to make about this. They need to see that domestic, family and sexual violence are corrosive issues that are at the core of our society and from which so many other issues stem: homelessness, problem gambling. So many things are connected to this that cost the government money. So the paradigm shift I'd like to see from them is to see that underfunding this sector is a false economy, because if you underfund it and you keep this just sort of like grinding along, it will continue to cost governments billions of dollars over the coming years. If we start to be serious about it, we might actually end up saving money. We might end up actually, you know, fixing issues that we thought were unrelated, but turn out to be all interconnected. This is the central social issue of our time. And if governments can't rise to that occasion, voters need to tell them so.
Jess, we've only been able to skim the surface of this very complex issue, but thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Noor.
That was journalist and author Jess Hill. You can find more of her work on theguardian.com, and we've linked to her latest piece on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, sound design and mixing by Camilla Hannan. The executive producer of Full Story is Miles Martignoni. If you or anyone you know needs help, you can contact Australia's National Family, Domestic and Sexual Violence Counselling line on 1800 RESPECT or 1800 737 732. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also leave a review. I'm Noor Haidar. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.